Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Christopher Houston Carson was 5'4" tall, slight of build, and, as Mountain Man Pulp Fiction hero Kit Carson, a giant in America's 19th century romance with manifest destiny. As Kit Carson set out on the Santa Fe Trail in 1826, so was America heading west. As he scouted and rode in the Mexican War, the United States scooped up the great Southwest that would send the country from sea to shining sea. As he married and slaughtered the first Americans, Arapaho, Ute, Comanche, Navajo, the new Americans made their bloody war and peace with the old. A new book, Hampton Sides, Blood and Thunder, makes the old story more honestly real again. Up next on Point, Kit Carson and the taking of the American West. Joining me now from Memphis, Tennessee, and we're delighted to have him, is Hampton Sides. He's editor-at-large at Outside Magazine, author of the 2001 bestseller, Ghost Soldiers, the story of World War II's Bataan Death March. His new book is Blood and Thunder, an epic of the American West. Hampton Sides, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
So here is one of these great, big, sprawling American West books that is at the same time brimming with that kind of romance of that time that Americans have savored for way more than a century at this point, and right next to it, a kind of reality check on what that time was really like and the role of different people right in the middle of it. And you've got Kit Carson right in the middle of it. Why have you built this one around Christopher Houston Carson, Hampton Sides?
Well, I live in Santa Fe. Live a couple hundred yards from the old Santa Fe Trail, and living in New Mexico, I keep running into this figure, this name, Kit Carson, and I'm a big believer as a historian in sort of asking the obvious question, who was this guy? And same was true with Ghost Soldiers, my last book, with the Bataan Death March. More people from New Mexico than any other state were killed in the Bataan Death March, and that led me on that odyssey. In this case, Kit Carson is everywhere in New Mexico. Kit Carson National Forest, Kit Carson Park, Carson City, Nevada is, you know, counties, rivers, passes named after this guy. So I just kind of asked the obvious question, who was Kit Carson? I vaguely thought that he was a fictitious character, like, you know, one of those guys in a Wild West show or perhaps, you know, one of these mythic gunslingers who was really
the Buffalo Bill
exist.
Type. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the more I dug into this guy, the more I found out that he was, you know, the real McCoy. He was an authentic kind of pre-Westerner, as I call him. He was there in the West before the Western cliches that we've grown up with had solidified. You know, there were no black and white hats. There were no Stetsons. There were no cowboy boots. Most of the white guys ran around speaking Spanish and French. And instead of driving cattle, they were driving sheep and on and on it goes. It was a very different West and a more interesting time to look at how the whole mythology of the West got started. And so it kept me busy for about 4 or 5 years just sort of following this larger story, but also following the constant travels of this one man, Kit Carson.
I'm sure it would fill at least 4 or 5 years. I mean, the taking of the West is a sobering story, but it is at the same time an astounding story, just how wide open it looked to Americans at that time, and this life, as you tell it, as a kind of spine through a story that goes to the Mexican War, very high death toll, and a very big land grab by the United States, on into the Civil War, into a kind of trail of tears for the Navajo that Kit Carson was right in the middle of. He's lauded as a hero. He was certainly a hero, you remind us, in the sort of pulp fiction of that century. He's also, I was reading somebody here saying, you know, Kit Carson is to the Navajo as Hitler was to the Jews in World War II. He's become a controversial figure in some precincts.
Very
as we've had our reconsideration of this history.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, how can the same man be all those things? But he is, and I think a lot of the reason why he is so much hated in Indian country is because of the effect of these terrible pulp novels, these dime novels. The cumulative effect of these thousands of stories still has some purchase on our national imagination, even though we, you know, I've never read these books until I did the research for this book.
But millions of Americans did for a long time.
And you know, I said I thought Kit Carson, as I got into this project, was a fictitious character. Well, you know what? He was a fictitious character. He became caricatured in these terrible books that were called Blood and Thunders, which is where the title comes from. You know, he was always presented as larger than life, dashing, eloquent, always gets the girl. It was said that he would kill two Indians before breakfast, which was, I guess, considered a good thing back then. And yet Kit Carson never was consulted with these books. The authors of these novels never endeavored to really get the real story about Kit Carson. He certainly didn't make any money off these books. And the ultimate irony is that he couldn't read them because he was illiterate. So he had to have them read to him by people around the campfire.
And when they were read to him, you recount him not being all that impressed with the veracity of the stories that he heard. And yet you can see why they came. I wish you'd read a little bit from your book, Hampton Sides, right at the very beginning in Blood and Thunder. Just the scale of this man's sort of life range, it can make you feel very small in 2006. There's a great opening paragraph there I wonder if you'd read for us.
Yeah, well, you know, I talk about how far he wandered and how many thousands of miles he traveled, and I tried to do a lot of this on my own in my Volkswagen diesel Jetta, and you have to remember he did all this on the back of a mule. I'll pick up here. In the two decades that he had lived and wandered in the West, Christopher Carson had led an unaccountably full life. He was only 36 years old, but it seemed he had done everything there was to do in the Western wilds, had been everywhere, met everyone. As a fur trapper, scout, and explorer, he'd traveled untold thousands of miles in the Rockies, in the Great Basin, in the Sierra Nevada, in the Wind River Range, in the Tetons, in the coastal ranges of Oregon. As a hunter, he had crisscrossed the Great Plains any number of times, following the buffalo herds. He had seen the Pacific, been deep into Mexico, pushed far into British-held territories of the Northwest. He traversed the Sonoran, Chihuahuan, and Mojave deserts, gazed upon the Grand Canyon, stood at the life-leached margins of the Great Salt Lake. He had never seen the Hudson or the Potomac, but he had traced all the important rivers of the West, the Colorado, Platte, Sacramento, San Joaquin, Columbia, Green, Arkansas, Gila, Missouri, Powder, Bighorn, Snake, Salmon, Yellowstone, Rio Grande. Carson was present at the creation, it seemed.
Hampton Sides, reading from his new book, Blood and Thunder. And I have to say, reading it again, it was jaw-dropping all over again. This is a man on foot and muleback, covering more of the country than Americans today in their Jettas or any other gas-powered engine are ever likely to see. How old was he when he set out? He had to get an early start to, by 36, have seen all that.
Well, he had run away from home at the age of 16. His father had died when he was a young boy, and he had been apprenticed to a saddle maker in Missouri. Mm. And he hated this work in a shop, working with these little, crimping tools and things. And he decided to bail, basically, which was considered, illegal to run out on
your apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he signed on for one of these enormous merchant caravans that was heading west on the Santa Fe Trail to New Mexico, which you have to remember was part of Mexico then. So it was really jumping off into a new world.
Mexico, which had just achieved its own independence in 1821. So this was a very new, loosely governed country.
Definitely. And prior to that, the Spanish had not allowed any trade with the United States. So as soon as Mexico achieved its independence, there was kind of a new window that had opened, and consequently the Santa Fe trade and the Santa Fe Trail became a big, very important thing and a very kind of romantic notion. The young men from Missouri with any spark of ambition wanted to head out on the trail and make a new life for themselves. And he was one of those guys at age 16 headed out to Santa Fe. Didn't like it too much, so he almost immediately went up to Taos, and that was his home for the rest of his life. And The reason he was drawn to Taos was because it was the headquarters of the Southwestern fur trade. This whole fraternity of grizzled old mountain men.
Jim Bridges and Jedediah Smith and the whole crew.
And these guys had explored the West and had, you know, had all these amazing stories to tell. And he really wanted to be a part of this group and wanted to, you know, become a mountain man himself.
So we think of that image of the free and easy mountain man. Of course, he married a couple of times to Native American women and then again. But he also got involved in the very, very much the matters of state of this country. Traveled, 14, 15, 16,000 miles on muleback for James Polk, president, in the Mexican War. Was right back in the thick of things during the Civil War. This was a man who lashed his knowledge into the Manifest Destiny agenda pretty hard.
Well, you know, it all goes back to these mountain men and the knowledge that they had accrued over this fairly short period of time when, because of the vagaries of fashion in Paris and London, it was decided that beaver felt hats were the greatest hat you could have. Very, very soon after that, it was silk hats and the fashion trends moved on. But for this little window, enormous sums of money were to be made in trapping beaver.
Hampton Sides, let me take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Ron's on the line. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hampton. Look forward to reading your book. I have a family story that I think might be interesting to you.
Let's hear it.
My last name is Berryessa. It's an old California name dating back to the middle 1700s.
Did you say Bowie as in B-O-W-I-E?
No, I'm sorry. Berryessa.
Berryessa, okay.
Spanish name.
Good, yep.
It was originally, the family was given large tracts of land, well over 300,000 acres, in land grants by the King of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And we were essentially one of the Northern California Don family during the Spanish reign of California. And in the ensuing decades after...
So what are you doing in Tennessee?
Hey, we're Americans. We move.
That's right. I'm one of the first of the family that moved out of the area.
Okay.
But regardless, the situation that happened regarding Kit Carson is very interesting.
Mm.
A great-great-great uncle. In fact, my wife and I dug out a newspaper transcript reporting this. So it's not just family lore.
Yeah, let's hear it.
But a great-great-great uncle, and I apologize, I don't have the exact year, was disembarking out of the bay of Monterey Bay, off of a ship in a boat, landed on the beach and was met by a General Fremont. And I don't know if he plays a role in Hampton's book.
Absolutely. He certainly does, a big one, yes.
And this incident, this is in the book. Keep going.
He met up. Kit Carson was at his side along with some soldiers as my great-great-great-great-great uncle
stepped off the boat.
Literally out of the water. The newspaper article reads out that he was literally shot dead by Kit Carson without, I think, any words being passed. And it's just a real interesting talk about the politics of the time. And the things that were going on, there was a lot of intrigue.
Well, that was family history, but this is right in the middle of the history that you write as well, Hampton Sides. And Ron, thank you so much for sharing that. Hampton, give us the context here.
Well, that story is true, and it is one of the more inexplicable episodes in Kit Carson's life. But essentially, there were actually two twins who were 19-year-old twins, the DeHaro twins, who were embarking from a boat. And there was some thought that they might have had dispatches on their person somewhere. There were some words exchanged, and then Kit Carson looked to Fremont, his superior, and said, "What do you want me to do with these guys?" And Fremont said, "I have no use for prisoners." And then he said, "Well, what does that mean?" And Fremont said, "Mr. Carson, your duty. Do your duty." And he said it again. And Carson turned around and shot him dead. And that says a lot about his personality.
What year would this have been, Hampton?
This would have been during the Mexican War, 1846, in California, in San Francisco Bay. And it's, Kit Carson was the sort of person who, number one, I mentioned that he was illiterate and that he was somewhat deferential to people who were better educated and better connected than he. And certainly this was a time during the American Army where, you know, you can't even do it today. But this whole idea that some orders you can carry out and others, you know, I just don't think I'll carry that one out. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you get an order, you pretty much have to do it. So not that lets him off the hook morally, but it was a different time. And there had been a massacre of some American settlers shortly before this, and tensions were high, and there was a lot of inflamed sentiment. And there was a context out of which this episode grew. And one of the accounts said that these DeHaro twins, in fact, had these secret dispatches on them. But it does show something about Kit Carson's larger character and how he continues to get these sort of dirty orders to carry out kind of the sharp edge of Manifest Destiny, both in the Mexican War, the Civil War, and the Indian Wars. He's been called Manifest Destiny's henchman a field agent of the larger kind of, you mentioned the slogan of Manifest Destiny.
Yeah.
And so this is one of those little episodes.
Wow, and one that lives in Ron's family's history. Ron, if that's it, there are the details, and they're laid out in the book. Hampton, describe for us how Kit Carson moved in and out of these roles. I mean, at some points you've got him here. He's just out. He's a mountain man. He's trapping. He's going to these unbelievable annual rendezvous out in the West where the mountain men would get together. Lord knows how long it would take them and, you know, have a great big party and then go back out. And then suddenly he's in service to the U.S. government. He's riding his mule for thousands and thousands of miles during the Mexican War, going all the way back to the East Coast, delivering messages, taking things out to the West. Mm-hmm. How does he get pulled in for that duty?
I kind of think of Carson almost as a Zelig type figure. You know, one of these characters who just inexplicably pops up like a chameleon, you know, in these different sorts of situations and is intersecting with, you know, his history and with historical figures fairly effortlessly. And he did move in these different worlds seemingly effortlessly. I mean, he was a mountain man. He spoke French and Spanish. Then his first wife is Arapaho, and he learns the Arapaho language and really marries into that tribe. And
her name's Singing Grass, a great beauty in that tribe, as you describe it, that he fought over for her attentions and took one of his serious wounds with a Frenchman.
Yeah, he had a duel at one of these mountain men rendezvous over the, you know, to win the Singing Grass. They had two daughters, and she died in childbirth, and then he married his second wife, who was Cheyenne, although that marriage didn't last very long. She kicked him out of her teepee in what they call the Cheyenne divorce. And then his third wife was Hispanic. Her name was Josefa Jaramillo from Taos. So I guess my point is he just moved effortlessly through all these different cultures and was sort of multicultural before that was a concept before that was hip. And that's one of the things that drew me to this character is that just as soon as you think you understand him, he's moved on to another phase. And so the question is, you know, how did he get pulled into the U.S. government and more official roles in the Army? He led these various topographical corps expeditions into the West for Fremont, who was just mentioned. And those were very important expeditions, both in terms of what they described and what they mapped, but also in terms of just unleashing this tidal force of Western immigration, settlers along the Oregon and Santa Fe trails. And so, you know, here he was, a lover of the great Western wilds, in a sense, playing a key role in fouling his own nest, so to speak, by bringing in all these settlers, changing the West, and sort of civilization is catching up with him because of his very actions.
Yeah, a very kind of ambiguous and fascinating role here. Let's take a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Kyle is on the line. Hi, Kyle, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, I really enjoy your program.
Thanks, Kyle.
I'm originally from Colorado, and it's the dichotomy of Kit Carson. I kind of equate him to Forrest Gump, where he shows up in all these different places.
Forrest Gump with a couple of knives and a long rifle.
My family history is my great-grandfather on my father's side was a Spaniard that lived near Fort Sumner, New Mexico, with 8 or 9 Indian wives. And then my mother's side of the family were white German settlers that came
a covered wagon from Illinois to Colorado.
Kyle, we're losing your line pretty badly there. I don't know if you're speaking directly into the phone. But Hampton, I hope you could pick up some of that. Here's another family story that goes back right into this region, into marriage, into the Native American population there, and Kit Carson, of course, right in the midst of that.
Yeah, well, and Colorado is where he spent a lot of his life, and all these stories intersect. I mean, you know, I think we tend to think of the West as being this kind of monolithic place, you know, where everyone either had a black hat or a white hat, or you know, they were Indian or they were white. Mm. These cultures intersected constantly, and the mountain men especially lived more like American Indians really than white guys in so many respects, and they fought with and against American Indians. The cultures constantly influenced each other. But I wanted to go back to his point about Forrest Gump.
Yes.
I really think that's a great analogy, and it's actually one I have used before. In the sense that Kit Carson has this amazing quality of serendipity, of just sort of lucking into, or perhaps often because of his skill as a trapper or an explorer, being in the right place at the right time to intersect with history, and constantly you're wondering, well, what's he doing? Mm. What's he doing in Oregon now? How did he end up in Washington D.C. carrying these very important dispatches? Now he's in Los Angeles, now he's in San Diego.
It seems almost impossible, just physically, yeah. Almost.
Yeah, and I just kind of I look at a map and I look at a chronology of his life. Mm. Even now, after I've done this for 3, 4, 5 years. Mm-hmm. I still don't know how he did it.
Let me ask you about the intersection of Kit Carson with Manifest Destiny, and that takes us in many ways to President James Polk, who had so much to do with the Mexican War and the giant addition of land to the United mm-hmm. States that entailed. Reintroduce us to James Polk and the vision of Manifest Destiny that he determined to act on.
Well, Polk is probably one of the more obscure American presidents. And yet he was probably very much on the short list of our most powerful presidents that we ever had, and also just the most efficient. This guy came into office shortly before the Mexican War with a very clear mission that he wanted to expand the national domain. He wanted all of the American West. He wanted ports on the Pacific in California. He wanted Oregon. He wanted Texas, he wanted the New Mexico territory, he wanted it all. And he was very clear and almost brazen in his ambitions. But he also said, you know what, I'm only going to serve one term, and then I'm going to get out of here. And it gave his presidency this almost exaggerated sense of deadline to accomplish all this stuff in such a short order. And you know what, he basically succeeded in everything he set out to do. He negotiated the Oregon Territory, he fought the Mexican War, he annexed Texas, and by the time he left office, the national domain had expanded by one-third, and he went home to Tennessee, and within 3 months, he was dead. So it's almost like he came up out of nowhere. He was our first dark horse presidential candidate, and he returned to nowhere, and he's still quite obscure. Fascinating guy. Very grim, very dour.
His youth, you describe prostate surgery that he had at pretty rough at age 17 or so, that may have left him impotent, and certainly was a hell of a procedure to go through, kind of shaped his view of life.
Well, I don't know for a fact, but it sure would have shaped my life. The operation that he went through was actually for some kind of urinary stones, and he had to travel hundreds of miles to meet with this state-of-the-art doctor who bored through his nether regions with this medieval tool they called a gorget. Just the description of the operation alone is enough to make you sick. But he, you know, with no anesthetic other than brandy. So yes, I think this probably had effect in on his very dour and very determined personality as he went through life.
And the Mexican War that he pushed into reality, first of all, by putting American troops down where there was almost inevitably going to be an incident, and then acting on it right away. 16,000 or something, a number like that, Americans died in that war. How long did it take? Where were the big battles? And when it was finished, mm-hmm. what did the U.S. have?
Well, in my book, I focus mostly on the taking of lands that are now part of the, you know, the U.S. I don't really go down into Mexico very, very much with the forces. I mean, the war in Mexico raged for 3-4 years, and there was an amphibious landing at Veracruz, and they took Mexico City, and there was, you know, we occupied Mexico City for over a year. There was a number of other battles that are consequential that kind of are tangential to my book, but I focus more on the on the great push of the, what was called the Army of the West, which was one of the prongs of the Mexican War, which was to basically send an army from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, along the Santa Fe Trail, the same road that Kit Carson had ridden in on, you know, a generation before, and to take Santa Fe, take all of New Mexico, and take California. And it was one of the longest marches in American military history, and they were successful. And you know, by the time, you know, I say in somewhere in the book that seldom in history has so much land been acquired by the simple act of a few men walking over it.
You're talking most of what is now California, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, Utah, parts of Colorado, Wyoming. I mean, just vast.
Now, you know, you can say that the Spanish and then later Mexican hold on much of this territory was quite tenuous. It was there on paper, and certainly there were settlements along the Rio Grande and right along the Pacific, but most of it was empty, completely empty, except for these other people, you know, Native Americans that really didn't constitute much of a, you know, the U.S. government didn't think of them as being a viable inhabitant, and
though it had been their home since time immemorial,
millennia. Yeah, and it's funny how they constantly, in the reports from Washington, ignore the existence of these tribes and their claim, of course, on the land. That was kind of a secondary thought. Once Mexico surrendered and this land became ours, then the U.S. government had to turn its attention to, oh yeah, you know, there are these tribes, and it's a cauldron of different tribes and different ancient wars and different cultures that have been here forever. And, you know, that larger social problem of trying to figure out what to do with this very complicated landscape emerges in the later chapters of my book as the, you know, kind of the centerpiece of the story.
Matt's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going?
We're all right. What do you think, Matt?
Well, listening to this, I'm hearing about economics and sort of military movements, but what happened socially to make this happen?
To make the westward push of American settlers, or which piece?
All these sort of single guys roaming the West, you know, sort of bothering Indians and taking land. Like, how did that? Was it easier because it's just a bunch of men? They don't have to bring their families with them, you know.
Of course, they eventually did. But Hampton, how do you look at that? I mean, Manifest Destiny, you describe how it comes out of a New York newspaper column. But many Americans were feeling it first as single men and ultimately as full families in those wagons.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of hard to underestimate the urge for land that existed back then. Free land, essentially, and the promise of starting over again, and the large influx of immigrants coming from England and Scotland and then Germany and Ireland, people who were hungry for land and never had had anything like you know, an opportunity like that before. So socially, that was one of the great factors that was driving these immigrants. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I don't think they set out to bother Indians. It's just that they got all these glowing reports from these Fremont expeditions that there was all this land out there in the Willamette Valley and the Columbia River Valley and California, Sacramento Valley, that was ripe for the taking. And, of course, most of these reports neglected to mention the claim that American Indians had on this land and certainly maybe didn't even recognize that American Indians were fully human. So you have to kind of view it all in the context of the time. So that was part of it. The other thing that was going on, we've talked about sort of economics and we've talked about social, but what about global politics? It's something that I forgot or didn't know. One of the rationales for taking California was a great fear that existed then that Great Britain still had designs on colonizing California. because they certainly had designs on the Oregon Territory and had sent their economic influence extended well down into California. So there was a great fear that if we didn't, you know, essentially take it now, we would forfeit the right to take it forever because of Great Britain. So there's a lot of little international intrigue going on here as well that fuels all this.
And you describe in detail how Americans were learning this story. I mean, the tales coming back, in no small part, the kind of tales told about Kit Carson began to be published and published very widely. You tell a very affecting story about how sort of fiction and fact and everything gets mixed up around Anne. Was it Anne White, the woman who died after being taken captive by a tribe in New Mexico? I wish you'd tell us that story. It says a lot about both the interaction of these populations and Kit Carson himself dealing with his legend.
Right. Well, you know, Kit Carson played many roles, but one of them was often to he seemed to get the call whenever someone went missing, because he was a really good tracker. And there was a family, the White family, and of course the name, the irony of the name is not lost on me, was attacked on the Santa Fe Trail by traitors. He was a traitor I guess the Jicarilla Apache Indians had set upon them. And Mr. White, Mr. James White, was killed, and all the men in the party were killed. But Anne White was kidnapped with her baby daughter and with a servant. Kit Carson gets the assignment to track her and hopefully find her. And he tracks her all the way to Texas. 12-day, one of the most difficult trails he's ever had to follow, but he does find the encampment of the Apache Indians. And when they descend upon the encampment, the Apaches scatter in all directions, and they find Anne White, who's been killed with a single arrow. And
body is still warm, arrow in the heart, you write.
Right. And I mean, you know, just a very, very tragic situation. But on her person, they find a book. The very first Blood and Thunder novel that had ever been written, that had come out earlier that year, that her family had brought with them from Missouri. And so here he was depicted in this book, Kit Carson, as a great...
larger than Indian, alive, yeah.
Not only Indian killer, but someone who in this very story rescues a kidnapped white woman. And she must have been reading this book. And, you know, maybe hoping that Kit Carson, the real Kit Carson, would show up and save her. Of course, in the real situation, he had failed. And so he sees this, and this is the very first time he encounters his own myth, this book. The irony being, of course, he couldn't read it. So he had to have somebody read it to him over the fire, and he hated it. And he told him to burn the damn thing.
Because it was so exaggerated. And also, he had just failed to do the very thing you write how it seemed to bother him for years, that she may have been hoping for just this legendary figure to show up, and he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sense in which throughout his whole life, starting with these bad Blood and Thunders, that this celebrity hounded him and raised this level of expectation that he could do these great things, when, of course, he was human and often failed. And it was certainly a source of tension in his whole life, the sense in which he was supposed to be this action figure hero, and when in fact, you know, he was just a human being.
I was very struck in that story with how American myth and reality were mixed up even in the midst of it happening. I mean, here's Anne White and her family coming west, but carrying the myth with them in the kind of pulp fiction about Kit Carson, who nearly saves her but does not. We've got to turn to the Navajo story before our time gets away. This is such a sprawling epic. But you write about this Army of the West, how they come into the Mexican War, so much land is taken. Now suddenly you have Americans more face-to-face, cheek-by-jowl with Native Americans than ever before. In the Civil War, this becomes a big issue, particularly with the Navajo. And you write about their equivalent, which once again Kit Carson is in the middle of, the sort of Navajo equivalent of the Cherokee Trail of Tears. Hampton Sides, please tell us that story.
Well, during the middle of the Civil War, an American general by the name of James Henry Carleton comes to New Mexico and, you know, realizes that all his peers are back east fighting the great battles of the Civil War and winning glory. And he feels, I think, that he needs to do something fairly spectacular to advance his army career. He recognized that the Navajo War has been going on for centuries between the Hispanic population and the Navajos, stealing each other's women and children and livestock and this kind of low-grade blood feud that was sapping the energy of the territory, and it just made life miserable. And he knew that something had to be done, but his solution was to send Kit Carson into Navajo country, force the surrender of this entire tribe, the largest tribe in the Southwest, and to move them 500 miles away to a kind of a prison camp situation that he had personally scouted. His idea was that at gunpoint, he could overnight teach this proud nomadic tribe of a sheep-loving tribe, teach them essentially to become Christian farmers and to live in apartment buildings like the Pueblo Indians, you know, big kind of dense structures.
It was a disaster. I wish you'd describe for us Kit Carson's role in getting them to move. They really couldn't pry them forcibly out of this Red Rock country that they knew so well with all of its canyons and crannies. So it was a starve-them-out strategy that Kit Carson led. How did he get the Navajo to come out and agree to this long walk, their own trail of tears?
Well, he couldn't fight them, so he had to fight their land. The Navajos didn't really concentrate in battle, and their landscape was not conducive to, you know, more orthodox kind of battle scenario. So he went in there and essentially chopped down every cornfield and destroyed every melon patch and bean patch. He had his soldiers guard the water sources and the salt sources, and he went into this beautiful, amazing place called Canyon de Chelly, which was famous, among other things, for its peach orchards, the pride of the Navajo people. And he went in there with his soldiers and had them chop down every last one of those trees.
3,000 peach trees.
3,000 of them.
Burned their baskets, smashed the pot so they couldn't even scrub up whatever food was left. I mean, it was really just a complete scorched earth policy to bring them to their knees, to get them to agree to go.
And this was a full year before Sherman's march across the South. And, you know, one of the first sort of concentrated efforts in American military history of scorched earth, essentially. And, you know what? It worked. The Navajo started to surrender in very large numbers, and nearly the entire tribe did surrender, over 9,000 Navajos. And so in a few short years, he accomplished what the Spanish and the Mexican armies and militias had been unable to do in over 300 years. So, you know, again, this accrued greater fame and fortune because of this mission that now is looked upon, you know, understandably as a terrible, brutal campaign.
People have painted Nazi on his gravesite in more recent years, but when you look back, there it was. I mean, the distance that the Navajo fell, I read you capturing in the story of this one great Navajo chief, Narbona, if I pronounce it correctly, 6 feet tall, something like 80 years old at the moment when he intersects with the American Army, and one of those stories that just, it's kind of gut-turning as an American to both acknowledge the stature of these people, but then have to look at how they were cut down at the same time. Him making a deal with the U.S. government, having his portrait done in the midst of U.S. troops, if I've got it right from your account.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then being killed all in the same day. Tell us the story of Narbona and his shocking end.
Well, this is, you know, one of the early patriarchs of Navajo country, and Narbona is really his first encounter with an American army. This is not Carson, by the way. This is a little before Carson,
yes.
The colonel's name was John Washington. And so, in the very first encounter between the American army and the Navajos, resulted in the most eminent Navajo leader being killed in a stupid argument over a stolen horse. He's cut down, and then he's scalped. So understandably, Navajo-U.S. relations got off to a very, very bad start.
You're right. New Mexican souvenir hunter walked up to the old man's corpse right there within minutes, it seems, of him being cut down, leaned down, and raked a sharp knife across his forehead. This, the preeminent leader of the Navajo.
Mm-hmm. And this was all a peace negotiation, and, you know, you're
quote,
stuck
unquote.
By and, yeah, and in this story, in this incident in particular, but throughout the story, there's all these moments where you just say, you know, There was a window of opportunity there. There was a chance. You know, this is a giant landscape. There's room for everybody. There were moments of amicable relations that seemed to be leading somewhere. And then invariably there's some kind of tragic incident like this. That seems to be true throughout history that, you know, if you look back, there are those moments, those watershed moments where if things had just turned out just slightly differently, the whole course of history could have changed.
Kit Carson, in the middle of this history, a hero of Pulp Fiction, a lovable man in many respects, Hampton Sides writes, but he also describes him as a natural-born killer. Brianna's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Brianna. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I am calling because I just read, I'm sure your writer knows the book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure.
A book that I think dispels a lot of the myth that's gone on in our country as to our conquering of, you know, lands that was already occupied by people. And I just wanted to say quickly that I really appreciate you writing this book, and if your book works to dispel that myth even more, I think that that's a great commendable thing to that you've done.
Brianna, thanks very much for that. Our time grows so short. Remind us of how General Tecumseh Sherman comes back into this picture and ultimately releases the Navajo from this giant prison camp in New Mexico, mm-hmm. Hampton.
Well, after the Civil War, the U.S. government awakens to the fact that this prison situation, this great reformation of American Indians with the Navajo situation, had failed abysmally. What had happened essentially is the 9,000 Navajos had been force-marched there on their long walk, and they began to die in huge numbers because of cholera and dysentery and venereal disease, and they weren't able to grow crops. It was a poorly scouted site. There wasn't enough water or good land or firewood. So basically what happened is Sherman comes in, and this man, no sentimentalist on the subject of American Indians or any subject as far as I can tell, having recently completed his own force march across the American South, comes in and sits down and realizes that this is just a huge failure. And not only is it a huge failure, but it's extremely expensive to keep this once proud nation of Indians as wards of the state, essentially. So his idea is to move them all the way to Oklahoma, even farther from their homeland, the preferred dumping ground of American Indians for generations. But he meets with some of the Navajo elders, and they tell their story and talk about how much they want to come home. And he's moved by some of the speeches that he hears and decides to grant them their wish. So, you know, there's another march.
You describe them falling onto their knees with joy as they finally get back to their native ground. And these words, Kit Carson had died just 5 days or so before Sherman comes on the scene here. You quote Sherman saying, Kit Carson was a good type of a class of men, most useful in their day, but now as antiquated as Jason of the Golden Fleece, Ulysses of Troy, the Chevalier La Salle of the Lakes, Daniel Boone of Kentucky, all belonging to a dead past. What year did Kit Carson die, Hampton? We've just got a few seconds here.
This is the spring of 1868, and it's extraordinary to me that Kit Carson dies the very week Sherman is deciding the fate of the Navajos so they can go back to their homeland. And what I want to say in closing is that, in a way, this is one of the very rare stories of where the U.S. government reversed course and saw that this wasn't working and essentially said, you know, we're sorry, go home. Consequently, the Navajo Nation is the largest reservation in North America, and it's the largest tribe in the U.S.
Mercy at the end, a lot of death before it came. Hampton Sides, the new book is Blood and Thunder. Mr. Sides, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.